it's good to talk to you, Joe.
Yeah.
Love the CD.
Thank you very
much. Strange, beautiful music.
All right.
It isn't really that strange, though.
I guess not, no. It's not, it's not really... Well, I guess sometimes I think it's strange because of what it is, just in general. And not a whole lot of people doing guitar instrumental, you know, rock music, so...
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know.
I mean, years ago, when I was a kid, and that was a long time ago, there was guys like The Ventures out there, and there was Jimi Hendrix, and Eric Clapton at his peak, and people like that that were just playing guitar and doing a lot of good music.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be as prevalent nowadays.
Yeah, I would tend to think, you know, that if you look at it in a really broad sense, that the way that people spend their time getting entertained has become more and more visual and tactile. In other words, if they can't look at it or manipulate something about it, then it's fallen behind in terms of a pastime of a generation. And so more and more entertainment is geared towards the visual and what that artist does. That's why most music is geared towards the vocalist now, not really the band itself or individual players in the band, you know, where they get different spotlights. It's all about the singer. And if you listen to, you know, hit radio or even, you know, modern rock for, you know, a couple of hours, you'll notice that the arrangements of the songs put the singer through most of the work. And there's very little in terms of instrumental refrain, not to mention a solo of any kind. So it's kind of an art form that is not really, the most commercial at the moment.
It's interesting, but, I would it be easier for you than to start writing lyrics and having someone singing with you and doing it that way?
I still think it's one of the hardest things in the world to compete in the pop world. You know, for every there are very few successes in pop music. You know, and between the two of us, we could name the top 10 in the last 10 years. And not only are there very few of them, but they're already gone. You know, half of them can't survive. So it's a genre that sort of can make people extremely popular, but then it sort of chews them up, spits them out, and sends them away.
Well, 14 years ago, actually it was more like 16 years ago, when Surfing with the Alien came out, you've now had a 15-year career with 7 million albums sold and now a strong one and a Grammy nomination again. This year you're nominated for the Best Rock Instrumental Performance for Starry Night. So there's no slowing down for you.
No, not at all. I'm really fortunate that, I connected with what I really like to do and that somehow got connected up with an audience around the world that really still loves to experience. They like to listen to it. In a number of different contexts, you know, in their car, at their house, wherever, you know, they're out doing things, and they probably even more importantly to me, they love seeing me do it. So that keeps us not only making the records, but going out on tour, and that's real important for getting re-energized in that style of music when you get to do it in front of people, and you just sort of get to make it part of your life, you know.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the tour. You're starting this, I guess, next week in Reno and going all the way to Albuquerque.
Yeah.
February 7th. What is it like for you going on the road? Is it like it was 15 years ago, or is it different?
It's better now. When I look back, I think at the early tours I did, there was just more stress involved in not knowing exactly how to do it. And, I started going on road trips during the weekend when I was in about 10th grade in high school. And, boy, that's really hard to know just basically how do you leave home and just focus on this one thing that's pretty crazy and everyone's, all your general rules about how to get from hour to hour and day to day sort of go out the window and suddenly it's sort of like this crazy ski trip you're on forever, you know. And so you really do have to learn how to, sort of organize your life so that you eat and sleep and you act somewhat normal to get to the next day, you know. And believe it or not, that process can kill you, or it can make for a really interesting, you know, way of life. And I think over the years, I learned how to do it better. So now, the traveling part and all that kind of stuff, all the craziness that goes along with being in the entertainment world, sort of is an easy thing to handle. And when I walk on the stage, it's just so much easier to be completely committed to just playing whatever comes to my mind, and, you know, using every piece of what I've worked on all these years, and sticking it right into the guitar performance. Mm. And, you know, I mean, 16 years ago, it was a lot harder because I think I was still stressed out from just traveling, doing interviews, wondering about, you know, where the next gig was going to be, and dealing with musicians. And then just little things like, is my amp working? Is this the right setup for this kind of a gig? And it was... it's the kind of thing that I see it in young musicians all the time, and I think that's why those first couple of tours can be so traumatic, and some people don't really survive, or they finish them and they think, this is not for me. You know, it's just too crazy. But I learned from some great, you know, early on from some really great musicians. I toured with Greg Kinn for about a year, right before the recording and release of Surfing. And then upon the release of Surfing, I toured twice with Mick Jagger in 1988.
Hmm.
And a few years after that, I spent less than a year touring with Deep Purple. And you know, in between, I was doing my own tours. But I learned from these great musicians who really knew how to excite a crowd, who knew how to create a moment, you know, with an audience. And also, they knew how to go from city to city. They knew how to treat their fellow, you know, roadsters, their musicians, their crew. You know, they knew the simple things, what to eat, what not to eat when you're, you know,
yep.
When you got to go on stage. I mean, it seems rather mundane, you know, but it is. The touring is a mixture of extremes and things that you would consider mundane.
Let's talk a little bit about the writing end of things, in terms of writing music. A lot of people, they when they start writing, they think music, they think lyrics in their heads. I assume that you think music. What inspires you to write? Is it things that kind of something in your head, or is it inspiration from something?
Yeah, I generally get inspired by an event, a person. Most of the time, it's stuff that's around me immediately, things that I'm still working out emotionally or something, you know, really great things, subjects that revolve around, you know, good times and bad times and relationships with people. And it's pretty much the same thing, except that I don't really have my burden of interpreting it is not a lyrical one. It's actually picking the right notes, not overplaying, you know, putting a melody forward that will evoke a particular feeling in the listener. But I don't try to go overboard, you know, where I insist that the audience, you know, knows exactly what, you know, inspired a particular song. Because one of the cool things about instrumental music is that it allows the listener to sort of reinterpret it for whatever mood they wish. And you know, it's sort of like if, you know, you think of songs like Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. I mean, that could mean a lot of things, really, and it certainly meant a lot of things to me until I learned about Beethoven's life and found out it was about unrequited love. But you know, I had other feelings about that song for years as a kid hearing it, you know, and cartoons, and then
yeah.
And then you grow up and you're studying it as a musician, and you know there are so many levels to relate to instrumental music, that it would be a shame if the composer forced on you his experience, you know, and so you always had to think of, okay, you know, he didn't get the girl and he wrote this song.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting if you juxtapose when we were growing up, before videos came, that even with the lyrics, you still had different interpretations of the music.
Yes,
and now, instrumentals are a one step farther from that, where you really have total interpretation of what you're listening to.
Yeah, I knew that when the, you know, we've made a few videos. We actually have a collection that'll be coming out on DVD soon of all the videos that we did during the period where we've made videos, you know, from the surfing record up until, I guess it was Time Machine was the last record where we, you know, we attempted to service MTVs to videos to MTV, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we did a video for a song called Always With Me, Always With You, and the impact that that had on people was pretty profound, because they just, they couldn't get it through their head that the girl in the video was not my wife, you know? And they would, you know, fans would say, that must be, you know, Rubina. And I said, well, no, that's just an actress, you know, just twirling around in the desert, you know, just for effect, you know? And I thought, well, that's really a shame in a way, because, you know, people who saw this video first cannot get it out of their mind that I'm out there in the desert wearing a duster, the wind is blowing, there's trash all over the road, and we're out there playing. Why? I don't know. And then there's this person, I don't know, that this woman, a beautiful girl, and she's dancing around in slow motion, everything. And, you know, people absorb that. And then, you know, there's that other part of the audience that just brought it in to their hearts without seeing anything, and it became their song.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, that's, you know, if I can ever get away with not doing a video, that's the way I'm going to go.
Now, how long have you been married?
Oh, wow. I think we made it official in 1981.
So, do you have any children?
Yes, one son. He's 10 years old.
And is your son musically inclined?
Very. He got a jump on it early and is a very natural guitar player.
Hmm.
That's pretty amazing.
Has Dad played? Have you played on stage with him yet?
You know, I think he comes on tour with me, so he's played the first note of a couple of concerts, you know, where he's standing on my side, and I'll have him grab the guitar and hold on to, let's say, the first note for Flying in a Blue Dream,
mm-hmm.
something like that. But I haven't brought him into the entertainment world, because that's something that, you know, they have to make that decision themselves.
And, absolutely.
You know, I don't want to be a stage parent or entertainment parent, whatever you call those, those entities, you know. So, but he naturally can teach himself chords and songs and... Yeah, last night before I went to bed, he was playing one of my guitars, and he was going through Smoke on the Water and a song by Coldplay. And it's really interesting, I mean, to you sit there and you watch a 10-year-old just sort of very naturally, you know, play a guitar that looks like it's oversized for him.
Does he sing as well?
Yeah, he's got a great voice, yeah.
Yeah. So you're going to have to start writing some vocal parts.
No, I mean, you know, his take on music is going to be so completely different because of his age and what he grows up with. I mean, he's so complete. You know, I mean, he is, like, into the widest scope of music. I suppose since he's got a dad who, you know, who grew up listening to and learned how to play during, you know, the classic rock period, you know, and then, of course, you know, my studio is right next to his playroom, so he hears everything going on that I'm working on in its dissected form as well as in its finished form, and he sees us play live, and you know, he's close friends with the whole band and the crew and all that kind of stuff. So, but at the same time, he, you know, he'll make, like on his iPod, you know, he listens to Steppenwolf, and it goes right into the Gorillaz or Beastie Boys, and then it goes back to Deep Purple, and it's just, you just wouldn't believe.
That's a nice mix.
Yeah, the mix of music he loves.
Now, I assume that you taught him how to play guitar.
Yeah, I guess every couple of weeks he says, can you show me how to do this? And I, you know, I don't give him lessons. We don't have a set time. I'm not sure he's like that, you know.
So who taught Joe Satriani how to play guitar?
Well, I usually say that I learned from, you know, Jimmy Page, Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, you know.
But did did you actually take lessons? Did you actually sit and learn, or did you do it all by ear?
No. I definitely took a couple of key lessons along the way. For the first 4 years, it was a mixture of being, you know, 90% self-taught, and then I would, like, take two lessons from this guy, and then a year would go by, and I'd take two lessons from that guy. And so I had a lousy experience in the beginning, you know, a guitar teacher that was just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I went for 2 weeks and then gave it up. But I kept the chord book. And then about 2 years later, I took 3 weeks of lessons from a really great jazz guitarist, and I bought his pamphlets on scales and arpeggios. And then I went and I just taught myself from those pamphlets for another year or so. Then I took about 2 months of lessons from a bebop legend, a piano player named Lenny Tristano, and those were amazing lessons in music. Now, during that period, I was still in high school, so I was also taking music theory classes in school, and in those days, growing up in New York State, you were tested by what they call the Regents Board,
mm-hmm.
which is a state education board that had standardized testing. So it was pretty rigorous. It wasn't free education kind of thing.
Right.
It was serious stuff, and you know, you were tested, and you got a grade, and it determined how you moved on. So
it's interesting to note that you were talking about some of the great legends that you grew up listening to. They're the same ones that I grew up listening to as well. And that recently English guitar magazine called Total Guitar had you as the sixth greatest guitarist of all time, behind people like Hendrix, Clapton, and Page.
Yeah.
Did you ever dream that you would be breathing the same breath as the people that you idolized as a youth?
Never. I mean, that's just so... That's one of those things I can't really hold. It's a concept I can't hold in my mind, because I see what those guys did as just such an unbelievable leap in creativity and application of music. And each one of those guys, I mean, Hendrix is my number one, you know, influence, but equally I think of a guy like Jimmy Page, who not only, you know, took all the music that went before him and made it current, you know, for his generation, but not only, you know, not only just from a guitar standpoint, but also as a producer and a songwriter, his work is almost unparalleled. It's incredible.
And it's interesting to note that, at least with me, when I took guitar lessons, the first song I wanted to learn to play was Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, right.
that was the one everybody, you know, ding, 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 that everybody had to have that down.
You did, yeah. I can remember those periods where I think every high school party I went to, there was somebody in one of the rooms playing that song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And people standing around them going, let's see if he knows how to do it. You know?
Now, Strange Beautiful Music is on Epic Records, which is a huge record company, part of Sony. How do they treat someone like yourself? I mean, do they ever tell you, you know, we want something that sounds, you know, hit feel, or do they leave you alone? You know?
They leave me alone. I think when they sort of brought me into Epic, they were bringing in an artist that had a catalog, you know, from Relativity Records, and they knew the history that Relativity nurtured my, you know, oddball creativity and never, you know, forced me to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the catalog is really big, and it continues to sell. I think we're past 10 million records worldwide.
Wow.
And, you know, since our association back in late 1986, early 87. And that, you know, as people in the entertainment industry know, catalog sales consistently over the year, that's what really makes a company successful, because it requires, you know, no money to maintain.
Right.
A brand new band that comes out, you know, that suddenly you see out of nowhere and struggles to sell a million copies, that band may have taken 4 or 5 million in startup costs, you know,
right,
for a label. And so, and they, you know, they try that with, I don't know, 10 or 20 bands every year. So they, the record companies are constantly trying to break new acts, and they're spending millions of dollars per act. And then on the other side, their business is maintaining artists like myself, where they don't really have to do anything because we're very self-sufficient. We have a worldwide audience, and, you know, we're not out chasing the latest fad. We're actually working from a sort of a artistic, musical vantage point.
Right.
And they love that, you know, from the fact that, let's say, the Epic Records, Dave Glue, the president, is just a guitar aficionado. He loves guitars. And that's why he brought myself and Steve I in, and he had, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan and Jeff Beck. He's got a lot of guitar players that he attracted to the label because he loves guitar players. And he never interferes. He actually, they, you know, every time we get to start a record, they say, what do you want to do and how can we help you accomplish this? And they're always excited about a new direction or perhaps a step forward in the same direction, let's say.
Right.
I've enjoyed my association with them.
Let me, I got a few more questions here. We're running out of time, actually. But one of the things that seems to be very lucrative for people who write music is movies and TV. Have any of those picked up any of your songs?
Quite a few, but spread out over the years. I think the most enjoyable one was I got to write a song for Cameron Crowe in a movie called Say Anything, and it turned out to be a song called One Big Rush that became a single for us, you know, and it wound up on the Flying in the Blue Jeans album.
Huh.
I love the process because, you know, he sent me a rough cut of the movie without any music in it, and he said, here are some specific scenes, and just, you know, write something that captures the essence of, you know, what the character's going through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so easy, you know, to do. I just love the whole process of it. And then since then, there have been what they call licensing, where I think Problem Child 2, I always see that showing up in my ASCAP statements. They licensed Satch Boogie. I think the Mario Brothers movie licensed a song called Speed of Light. So I have a couple of films that have just been what they call needle drops, where they license something that's right off the record.
Sure.
And you don't work on it. I've been sort of educating myself over the years to learn how to be more self-sufficient, because I think that's what it takes for writing for films. They want basically, you know, to visit you and you alone, and you have to provide them with the entire thing. So you have to be a bit of an engineer and a multi-instrumentalist, I think, to really get into writing movies to the point where you consider yourself like a Hans Zimmer or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And but I'd love to do that. You know, later in my life, when I really don't want to travel so much and jump around on stage, I would love to apply myself that way.
Now, where are you from originally?
I grew up technically in a town called Westbury, which is in Nassau County, which is in the middle of Long Island.
Oh, okay.
That large island that's right next to Manhattan.
On New York,
In New York.
Are you a New York sports fan?
You know, many years ago, I think it was turning into a guitarist, I finally backed away from being a sports fanatic. But early before that, you know, I was into all my local teams, all of which have been sold and traded. And since my parents were from the Bronx and Manhattan, they had their own allegiances. And I was even on the, you know, I was on the wrestling team, I was on the fitness team, I was on the football team. And but I kind of left that behind for rock and roll. So now I'm sort of like a fair-weather sports fanatic.
You know? Well, you see, you could be like doing this, the national anthem at one of their sports things. And
yeah, I've done it many times. I've played the national anthem for the San Francisco Giants, the Oakland A's, the 49ers, and actually re-recorded their theme song when they, you know, when they score a goal, and they play a version of the song called San Francisco.
Now,
a Blink 182 version of it for them, so they blast that.
Is your national anthem Jimi Hendrix type, or is it pretty much straight through?
You know, that's a good question. You know, the last time I did that, it was at a Seattle. Seattle game, and
mm-hmm.
The Chiefs against
the Seahawks.
Yeah, the Seahawks in that beautiful stadium of theirs. It was great. And, you know, still, I don't think the mood is right to play something that was sort of born out of conflict. You know, Hendrix's version was not only a beautiful expression of what he could do on the guitar, but he obviously, day-to-day, like anybody, you know, during that latter half of that decade, they were consumed with the social change and the Vietnam War and all the other controversies of modern life back then.
Right.
But when I walk out, you know, and I'm standing at the 50-yard line and I'm looking at the fans, it doesn't feel right to suddenly make a controversial statement. What it feels like is to create something that would foster unity. And, you know, it's the first one that I did for the 49ers was actually 2 days or a day before September 11th. Yeah, it was September 10th, I believe. And I remember how poignant it was because there I was in the middle of the field alone, and there were the Marines and the F-18s did a flyby, you know, right at the high point of the anthem. You know, back then, before September 11th, no one ever thought that something like that was going to happen. And it really changed, but it made me think once again that, you know, trying to take the anthem and being irreverent with them is not really the thing to do at a sports event. You know, it'd be like grabbing your crotch or something like that if you were a singer.
Yeah, a little rosy, yeah.
Yeah, that's just not what I'm into.
Joe Satriani is touring right now with his Evening With tour, and it's stopping at Reno Hilton Amphitheater on the 29th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento on the 30th, the Fillmore in San Francisco the 31st and February 1st, the New Classic Showroom in Kelseyville, California the 2nd, Ventura Theater in Ventura, California the 4th, San Diego on the 5th, and Tucson, Arizona on the 6th, and Albuquerque, New Mexico on the 7th. And you can keep up with his schedule and all the information on what's going on at www.satriani.com. And we will put a link on this interview to that site.
That's great. And, you know, if people want to see us somewhere else, we will be in South America, we'll be in Europe, we'll be in China, we'll be in India.
See, there are people listening all around the world, so...
Yeah, we will. Yeah. These dates have not been put up on the site yet, but they, you know, in a week or so, the rest of the schedule that takes us through the end of September will be up, so it's... we're sort of like in the middle of our strange, beautiful tour, as we call it.
Well, Joe, have a great time, and hopefully each town will look the same to you.
All right, thank you, Mark.
Take care.
All right.
Nice to talk to you.